Hello and welcome to The Late Debate with me, Audrey Carvel. Coming up on the programme tonight is organised crime destroying communities and a banquet fit for a president.
Your Majesty, we have moved on from a past where our relations were often troubled to a present where, as you have indicated, Ireland and the United Kingdom meet each other in mutual respect, close partnership and sincere friendship.
Join us after the news from Susan Jackson.
Thanks, Audrey, and good evening from the newsroom. President Higgins is attending a banquet at Windsor Castle tonight on the first day of his state visit to the United Kingdom. Addressing the guests before dinner, Queen Elizabeth said the Irish and British are becoming good and dependable neighbours and even better friends.
My visit to Ireland and your visit this week, Mr. President, show that we are walking together towards a brighter, more settled future. We will remember our past, but we shall no longer allow our past to ensnare our future. This is the greatest gift we can give to succeeding generations.
Tonight's banquet is being attended by a host of figures from the worlds of politics, entertainment and the arts, including former President of Ireland Mary McAleese, Northern Ireland's First and Deputy First Ministers Peter Robinson and Martin McGuinness, as well as Taoiseach Enda Kenny and his wife. Former Irish rugby international Brian O'Driscoll, the founder of the Druid Theatre Gary Hines, Oscar-winning actors Daniel Day-Lewis and Judi Dench are also among the 160 guests present. In his address, President Higgins acknowledged the role played in Britain by the Irish who emigrated there over the years.
The contribution of Irish men and Irish women to life in Britain, which Your Majesty has acknowledged with such grace, is indeed extensive and lends itself to no simple description. It runs from building canals, roads and bridges in previous centuries to running major companies in the present, all the while pouring Irish personality and imagination into the English language and its literature.
In other news, the government has agreed the terms of reference of the investigation into the secret recording of telephone calls at Garda stations. Supreme Court Judge Niall Fennelly will conduct the inquiry, which will complete its work before the end of the year. The Gardaí's handling of the death of Sophie Toscan de Plantier will also be examined. Olympic silver medalist Jonjo Nevin was told by doctors in hospital this evening he has broken both of his legs following an assault in Mullingar on Saturday. The incident happened in the Ardley area. The 24-year-old's right leg was broken in two places in the assault. This afternoon, a scan revealed that his left leg is also broken. The weather forecast dry with a lot of clear weather in most places, although much of Ulster and Connacht will be cloudier, with light rain at times on north and northwest hills or coasts. Lowest temperatures 3 to 8 degrees, coldest inland in the south and southeast, with slight grass frost locally. And that's all from the newsroom for the moment.
Susan, thank you very much indeed. You're very welcome back to The Late Debate. Firstly, a big thank you to Cormac and to Brian for being here for the past few weeks. We're almost a presidential-free zone tonight. The majority of our programme will discuss the apparent increase in gangland crime, organised crime and criminality, and ask if the authorities are losing this battle, and even if it's time to sit down and talk with the crime bosses. And joining me to discuss that will be John Mooney, security correspondent with the Sunday Times, John Redmond, Labour councillor in the Finglas and Cabra areas of Dublin, Dave Connolly, a community activist from Ballyfermot in Dublin, and Padraig McLaughlin, Sinn Féin spokesman on justice, equality and defence. First, though, we're going briefly to Windsor Castle in England, where a state banquet is being held in honour of President Michael D. Higgins as part of his state visit to Britain. Within the past hour, President Higgins and Queen Elizabeth made speeches. Here is part of hers first.
Mr. President, the goal of modern British-Irish relations can be simply stated. It is that we who inhabit these islands should live together as neighbours and friends. Respectful of each other's nationhood, sovereignty and traditions, cooperating to our mutual benefit, at ease in each other's company. After so much checkered history, the avoidable and regrettable pain of which is still felt by many of us, this goal is now within reach. I started by speaking of 10 centuries of history. But there is a balance to be struck between looking back at what has happened and cannot be changed, and looking forward to what could happen if we have the will and determination to shape it. My visit to Ireland and your visit this week, Mr. President, show that we are walking together towards a brighter, more settled future. We will remember our past, but we shall no longer allow our past to ensnare our future. This is the greatest gift we can give to succeeding generations.
And then the President spoke. He focused on building a future together, but always remembering what has gone before.
We must, however, never set aside or forget those who died, were bereaved or injured during a tragic conflict. As the French philosopher Paul Ricoeur wrote, "To be forgotten is to die twice." We owe a duty to all those who lost their lives, the duty to build together in peace. It is the only restitution, the only enduring justice we can offer them. We share also the imperative to be unwavering in our support of the people of Northern Ireland as we journey together towards the shelter and security of true reconciliation. We celebrate what has been achieved, but we must also constantly renew our commitment to a process that requires vigilance and care. Your Majesty, we have moved on from a past where our relations were often troubled to a present where, as you have indicated, Ireland and the United Kingdom meet each other in mutual respect, close partnership, and sincere friendship. That friendship is informed by the many matters of mutual interest in which we work together and support one another.
President Michael D. Higgins speaking at Windsor Castle just over an hour ago. Just briefly, Padraig McLaughlin, do you agree with what many commentators are saying about the significance of this visit?
I think that in some respects, maybe the establishment are catching up with where the Irish and British people have been for a long time. You know, there are, you know, a shared language, shared cultural interests, sporting interests, and so on for a long time there. What is important about it, though, is in terms of the peace process, I am proud that Martin McGuinness is there because he is an Irish Republican. Like me, he wants to see a united Ireland. If we are to achieve that, though, we have to demonstrate to unionism that we respect their history, their culture, their identity. And part of that is, engaging, you know, in these types of events, and also understanding that the outworking of a peace process is peace and respect between our peoples, you know, who have had so much conflict and division in the past.
But why do you feel proud that Martin McGuinness is there? I mean, he, you know, it's a long way from being an IRA commander in the Bogside, and everything about the ceremony and the state banquet in Windsor Castle surely must be anathema to Republicans.
Well, obviously, as Republicans, we don't believe in monarchy. We believe that all citizens are equal here in Ireland, but we respect the wishes of the British people. What I'm proud about is the leadership that's been shown by Martin McGuinness repeatedly. If you compare the leadership being shown by Martin McGuinness to, you know, at times the poor leadership from unionism, that's what I'm proud of. And I think he's taken decisive interventions at key moments, and no doubt he will continue to do that. And hopefully now we can have a refocus, because there's many things within the peace process that need to be looked at. Like, you know, the Haas talks demonstrated that we need to deal with the past. We need to deal with flags, emblems, parades. There are a range of issues that were parked after the Good Friday Agreement that need to be addressed. But most importantly, the past and answers and truth commissions for those who lost their loved ones.
Do you believe that the majority of the grassroots Republicans who would vote for Sinn Féin would also feel pride tonight? Or would many of them feel betrayed?
No, I think when I say pride, I mean pride in the leadership that Martin McGuinness, you know, we're not into pomp and ceremony or any of that, you know, malarkey. But in terms of the leadership that he's showing by being there, the respect he's showing for, you know, what's important to unionism, I think is what most Republicans understand. And Republicans understand that, you know, there are 1 million unionists on this island. If we are to achieve our objective, our legitimate objective of a united Ireland, we need to build those relationships and trust. And the fact is, we were at war. We put, you know, we caused huge harm to each other during that period of conflict, and we need to do everything we can to re-establish trust, and that's part of it.
But do you believe that you're getting reciprocal leadership from the unionist community at the moment?
No. And in terms of the Haas talks, it was very disappointing that they broke down. In terms of the flags and emblems, I can't understand why anybody in unionism thinks it's acceptable for a union flag to fly 365 days a year. I just don't understand that. It does fly for, I think it's around 32 days on designated holidays. There's no mention of the tricolour flying in a shared space. That's that. In terms of parades, there's 3,000 parades every year. A handful of parades are controversial. They don't believe in dialogue. I don't understand that. And in terms of the past, you know, it means that all victims are treated equally, that all contributors to the conflict accept responsibility equally, and that includes the British state. So, no, we haven't had the unionism we want, the leadership we want from unionism. But hopefully, with this initiative from Martin McGuinness, we'll see a return to the peace process principles.
And can I just bring you in just briefly, John, on this? I mean, we've heard President Higgins and Queen Elizabeth speaking about forging ahead with reconciliation, shared futures. Is that strong enough to resist the dissidents at the moment?
Absolutely. I've spent a lot of time dealing with dissident Republicans, and there's a lot of them, but there's not that many of them. And in many ways, in the strange dynamics that go on within that community, they, I think, themselves accept that their current, campaign is not going to go anywhere. But these people, I suppose, see themselves as kind of a part of a much more deeper and deep-rooted tradition going back an awful long time. And they really, at this point, see themselves as existing for no other reason but to have an IRA organisation exist and to continue with that tradition, that kind of militant Republican tradition. So these type of events and the choreography that's going on, and that where they are important is that it maybe, it dissuades young people that may have very romantic notions about joining the IRA from doing so. Maybe it would dissuade them slightly from doing that. That is one thing that I would think. And also to see the President of the Republic sort of participating in a kind of, celebration that could be seen as one of equality, and acknowledging what happened in the past, it takes that argument very much out of the hands of the dissidents. Like, you've got to remember, what is the IRA? The IRA was a psychology, which is, you know, the use of violence to achieve political objectives. The Provisional IRA occupied that space at one stage. Then you have these other groupings, and they've had various, you know, they're not like the Provisional IRA. They're much more fluid sort of entities, mm-hmm. With lots of different mindsets in them, and they are there still, and they will carry out attacks, and they will kill more people, but nothing on the scale of what's happened in the past. And the one thing that they don't have, and anyone who says they do is lying, they don't have support. They have a respect in the communities, but they don't have widespread support, and there's a big difference between the two.
And just before we move on to our substantive discussion tonight about organised crime, which I suppose will feed into in some ways to what dissident paramilitaries are doing at the moment, the commission of investigation into the Gardaí and the recording of conversations and so on, its terms of reference were published today. What's your assessment of them, John?
I find it almost incomprehensible. I just don't understand why Ian Bailey's case is being lumped in with the accidental recording or the recording of calls and telephone traffic into Garda stations. They're not connected whatsoever. Ian Bailey was a man who was, it appears in the face of it, and was a very deliberate attempt to frame him for a murder, which he'd no involvement in. And this went on for a long number of years under successive governments, under successive Garda commissioners, mm-hmm. and various other people, and everyone knew about it. And it was almost, you could describe it as mob mentality, what happened to that man and Jules Thomas's partner. Those issues that arise in that, as in terms of the you know, attempts being made to influence the DPP and the Chief State Solicitor's Office, the way he was treated, the government's own handling of this. Like, let's not forget, Alan Shatter is the Justice Minister who's allowing a French investigation team to come in and investigate a resident in the state on the basis of what now is generally accepted as corrupted Garda evidence. I mean, this is Twilight Zone stuff. How that has been put into an entirely separate issue, it actually,
so it shouldn't be
belief.
In there at all.
I don't believe so. I think if we were living in a functioning democracy, we would have a judicial review looking into the Ian Bailey case, and these other matters would be dealt with.
And
Paura,
can
else.
I just get your view on this as well, because you're Sinn Féin spokesman on justice and chairman of the Justice Committee. It's been said that the timescale that's being set down for Mr. Justice Fennelly is way too short. He has to report by the end of this year, and there is no way that he can possibly investigate up to 30 years plus of tape recordings in that time.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a need to separate out a number of matters. The circumstances that led to the resignation of the Garda Commissioner, the practices that were in place in the Department of Justice in relation to correspondence, the reason why, you know, the Attorney General learning about this in November of last year and it taking 4 months to get to the Taoiseach and then immediately a commission investigation. And of course, you know, the explanation around those 2 days, all of that could be done within 8 weeks. That's the time frame that Justice Cook has got in relation to the review of the allegations to Taoiseach office. So we would say that front load those aspects, the political aspects in the public interest, give them an 8 week time frame. So amend the terms of reference for that. In terms of the wider issues, I'm advised, you know, speaking to a number of people in the legal world tonight, there's no way that they're going to have that completed by December. Indeed, it could roll on for years.
Do you feel that your committee has been frustrated by what the government has done and by the terms of reference, that perhaps you're being prohibited almost, not there, they wouldn't use that word, but from investigating this and from calling people before your committee to ask them questions?
Yeah, the Justice Committee discussed this last week. I actually chair the Public Service Oversight Committee separately from the Justice Committee, but we discussed it last week, and I think there was certainly a view in the committee to deal with the resignation of the Garda Commissioner, that it was separate from, while obviously there's a chronological link to how it happened, it was separate and it needed to be looked at. It's now been included in the terms of reference, but the difficulty is that it could be years before we get some kind of answers on it. So what my position is, speaking as the Sinn Féin spokesperson, no doubt the other opposition spokespersons will agree, is that unless we can get reassurance that the terms of reference will be amended so that this is dealt with in an 8 week period, and indeed that some of the sessions would be public sessions because they do have that discretion in a commission of investigation, I think we would have to look at the Justice Committee seeking to bring in. Now, by the way, the Justice Committee cannot compel people to come before us. It's not like the PAC, but we could invite witnesses and try. So it'll be an interesting debate in the Justice Committee tomorrow.
So you may end up inviting who? The former Commissioner and the Secretary General?
Yeah, I my view is certainly speaking as a Sinn Féin spokesperson, unless we can get reassurance that these issues, these political issues, can be investigated thoroughly, swiftly, within an 8 week period, then we would be arguing the Justice Committee should deal with the matter.
What do you think of that, John?
Yeah, I would kind of agree with that. We've seen one crisis after another in the Department of Justice, really since the beginning of the year. And if these matters were to be dealt with properly, you'd have maybe 3 or 4 more investigations going on and effectively trying to snowball them into one. I would argue almost that it's designed to kind of ensure that none of the specific issues can be dealt with properly. I just don't believe for a split second, knowing what's going on in the back of the Bailey case, that is in any way connected whatsoever to illegal recordings of telephone traffic at Garda stations.
All right, we'll move on and talk about our substantive discussion tonight, organised crime and criminality, if it's on the increase, the effect on communities and what the authorities are doing about it. John Mooney is here, security correspondent with the Sunday Times, Padraig McLaughlin of Sinn Féin. Also here, John Redmond, who's a Labour councillor in the Finglas and Cabra areas of Dublin, and Dave Connolly, who's a community activist from Ballyfermot in Dublin as well. You're both very welcome. Dave, I'll start with you because you've been working in this area for a long, long time. How would you assess the scale of the problem as it is at the moment?
It's actually a difficult question to answer because it's quite a confusing scene now. There was a time maybe 10, 15 years ago when it was clear in terms of the organised crime and gangland crime. But it's very unclear now where it's coming from, who's involved in it. I think to sort of get directly into the impact at a local level, it's more the shocking experiences of sort of violence that breaks out now and again that has an impact. And an impact, I think, that's not fully grasped by people outside those communities, which is the impact both on families, neighbours, young people and the whole wider range. And that sort of trauma is something I think when you mentioned about looking at the impact on communities, that's where we need to start looking at it. But it's very difficult to judge. And I read John's articles and I read a lot of the, if you like, perspectives there are on organised crime, some of which, in fact, label particular areas as gangland areas, which I also think is quite a damaging concept. So in summary, to answer your question, I think we need to have a better understanding of what's going on to see what is involved that is organised. There's a lot of disorganised crime happening, inevitably, in a recession. And some of it is becoming more violent because of the access to guns and the whole drug-fuelled activity. But whether it's you could describe it as organised crime from a community level, I'm not so sure.
I know what you mean. But how extensive would you say are its tentacles in the community in which you live and work?
I think there's two ways of looking at it. Much of the original organisation, say in the drugs area, was concentrated in large working class areas. That's where it took hold first. And in fact, way back when I was involved originally in the whole drugs campaigning, the attitude of the guards at the time was, we're containing it within those areas and won't go any further, which was a disastrous perspective. So I think it is, important to say that that is where some of the people who ran this, those sort of crimes emanated from. But many of those have left, long left the country even. So now it's there's a lot of young people maybe involved or drawn in because there's money involved. But whether you could call it in an organised sense, you certainly don't on a daily basis in Ballyfermot or in the inner city where I work see that sort of sense of crime happening. The odd incident happens and very violent incident happens, which affects everybody, as I said. But you couldn't say it's a daily occurrence or even something that people are conscious of.
OK. John Redmond. John, you live in Finglas South. You've lived there for a long time as well. Finglas and Cabra, they have, bad reputations, is that fair to say? Is it still justified today?
Well, no, definitely not. I wouldn't agree with you there. We have moved from the 70s right into the present day and we've seen a massive big change. When I arrived to live in Finglas South in 1972, there was a shop, no shops, there was a van and a school and a church. That's all we had. So the whole makeup of the whole Finglas South area was very badly planned, mm-hmm. for a start. We went to live there in the 70s and there was nothing for children. No playgrounds, nothing whatsoever. We had the village. And subsequently, as the kids
grew... And was criminality a big problem at that time?
It came later, coming into the 80s. It came later when the kids start growing up, teenagers. And we did experience drugs and tried to contain it, as Dave said. And it was very difficult for myself, the community where we lived, and the surrounding area.
And you had your own direct experience of an attack on your home?
Because as a community activist in the area, hard-working postman and trying to start up initiatives in the area like keeping the place clean and environmental projects and then leading on to residence groups, I found that myself, the people who wanted to do something positive was being intimidated by these groups of individuals who were dealing in drugs. And in fact, my own home was vandalised and my property was vandalised. And there was a point in my life, and a lowest point that I never forget, where my mother was dying that particular week. That was the week my house was vandalised and I'll never ever forget it. That was 16 years ago. So it made me more determined. And I'm lucky that I have a wife, an understanding wife, who actually listened to me. And where I come from, Ringsend, we weren't intimidated and run out of our homes. We stood up, not violence with violence, but using your head and your brains and working with people for a better community. And that's where I am now.
But did you win the battle? Because there are still, there are still a lot of crime, gangland crime. I know you don't like the phrase, Dave, but, you know, it sums up what's been happening there.
It's a label that was put on Finglas. We had numerous shootings of young men who got involved in drugs. And I've met their parents and they're still alive and they are still suffering. Our community is still suffering of the loss of these young men who got involved through no fault of their own. I think it was discussed there a couple of seconds ago by Dave and John about outside influences that came in and just targeted working class areas, seeing a quick buck, made money out of it, and thereof swanning themselves into the likes of the Bahamas, foreign places. And a lot of those guys would be dead now, who were generals and various higher-ups in that particular sphere of the drugs. And they're long gone. And we have a new generation, as John was talking about. And where we are in Finglas at the moment, we've put in structures and worked as hard as we could with, I remember going back a number of years ago, the Minister for Justice at the time, Michael McDill, he set up the Joint Policing Committees right across the city. And I was actually one of the first community reps on the Joint Policing Committee. And we did work hard. The community themselves worked as hard as they could, because I remember going to numerous meetings with people. They were crying at the meetings. They were frustrated. They wanted to get out of the place. And now here we are 40 years later or 30 years later. We have structures in place like Joint Policing Committee. Our Joint Policing Committee and our safety forum in Finglas is an example to any safety forum right across the city. I would ask anyone to come out and just look at it.
John Mooney, have people like John Redmond and others won the battle against organised crime in their areas?
How would you answer that? Yes and no. The reason why, I suppose, if you look at sort of the development of organised crime in this country, it really did, there was kind of criminal gangs really going back into the 50s and 40s in the Dublin area, but really kind of mutated into have an semblance of organisation about it in the early 70s. And that was primarily with heroin dealing with inner city flat complexes and drugs as an issue was new to the state. People didn't know how to react to it, didn't fully understand the complexity of the problem and addiction, the problems that run with it, because it's a societal problem rather than a criminal problem. But people, criminals can make money from it. But I suppose what you saw really until about 1995 was working class areas in Dublin were particularly affected by this for the simple reason that maybe the family structures around kids that ran into trouble weren't there. Or maybe it wasn't the financial support to maybe get the treatment and sort of stuff that was required, and the state wasn't doing its job in relation to it. And the guards, to a degree, there were certain, I suppose, elements within the guards turned a blind eye to this. I remember a chief superintendent saying to me once that he worked for a guy and that if they didn't have any heroin seizures captured in their area, then they didn't have a heroin problem. And that was the attitude that was taken. In 1995, so there was, for a number of different societal reasons, ecstasy arrived into this country and crossed all social divides and kind of introduced a whole new market to drugs, and a lot of criminals became wealthy on that. And on the back of that, you saw a kind of transmission of all different types of drugs. So drugs are kind of a cyclical event. They happen with a mutation in them, maybe once every 10 years, where it was ecstasy in the 90s, it was cocaine in the noughties. We saw the late noughties just psychotropic drugs from head shops, etc. So that's one type of organised crime. So that blossomed and is now right across the country, and indeed it's right across the world. Then when you look at sort of criminal activity and the organised crime, what my two gentlemen here are talking about is the shootings and that happen in areas. Number one, they're happening in every community in Dublin now. That's not solely confined to Finglas or anywhere else, or Ballyfermot or anything like that. That is going on in Lucan. It's going on in Dunleary. It's going on whatever community has. Clontarf, there's been people murdered in drive-by shootings. So that's a sort of a symptom more of the malaise that goes on within society, that people are using drugs, etc. But in terms of organised crime, it's so big now in this country that it just gets quietly on with the business. And it's not really, drugs is only one aspect of it. And drugs, we see a manifestation of violence associated with it. So you get the tabloid newspapers follow this. You see the likes of Love, Hate. And people portray that as organised crime. I would argue that organised crime is something totally different, that is totally misunderstood. It's criminal activity that earns large amounts of money. It includes drugs, but it also includes diesel laundering. It includes cigarette smuggling. It includes...
You would argue that they are, in fact, almost the two biggest...
I can tell you, they would dwarf drugs any day of the week. The diesel laundering in this country is worth probably about 250 million at a conservative estimate. The tobacco trade is in full swing. The illegal tobacco trade is in full swing. A lot of dissidents are involved.
I was going to say, who's driving this?
Well, there's lots of different groupings, for want of a better word, right across. Number one, this is also a rural Ireland phenomenon in a major way, and that includes drug trafficking. Some of the biggest drug traffickers in the state now live on farms. They live in rural communities, have quite big houses. They're involved in legitimate business for 5 days of the week, and they drug traffic maybe once a month. They make money on that, and they've got a certain reputation. A lot of people wouldn't be aware of who these people are. So you've got lots of different type of issues. For example, on the oil laundering thing, former members of the IRA largely are controlling that. They have managed to set up a criminal organisation that has its tentacles right across Europe now at that stage. In fairness to Sinn Féin, they've severed their links with them. But this is a common problem in conflict situations, that you will see a sort of structure being set in place to fund a campaign. Mm-hmm. And then when that campaign comes to an end, there is a political solution agreed, you'll always get this rump that just won't stop. So that's what's happening there. But then you've got corruption and criminality in the farming community. We'd say we saw that in the horse meeting. They were turning over 65,000 per trailer load of contaminated beef that came into this country. Huge money. You look at, computer fraud, another big earner with gangs that are specialists involved in it. Criminals within the immigrant community is massive. I believe the guards having a proper handle on that whatsoever. We've got Eastern European gangs now involved in drug trafficking, prostitution, all those traditional forms of organised crime in the both provincial towns and urban environments. There's criminal gangs within the Chinese community that I don't believe the state are even aware of them.
Okay.
If you look at the cannabis grow houses, that's largely being run by Chinese groups that are selling to Irish criminals. So this is a big, big, big issue. There's no such a thing as the war on drugs or the war on organised crime, because wars come to an end. Governments manage this and they do their best to contain it. But if you look at the overall nature of this business, it's worth probably about $4 billion a year. That's it. In the black economy, that's what's going on. And then you have a situation whereby you have a handful of killings. You know, they're investigated, whatever. But by and large, this business continues every day of the week. There's no violence associated with it.
Corrig McLaughlin, listening to John there, I mean, it's huge, this problem. Are the authorities, is the government managing it to any extent?
There's two areas where the government are failing fundamentally. The first one I want to talk about, and Dave would be very familiar with this, is the very significant cutbacks to those at the front line in communities who are combating drugs, who are trying to support people who are disadvantaged, put in place, you know, training programs, community programs, community empowerment programs. There's been huge cutbacks across all of those sectors. So you're taking away from your people at the front line there. In terms of the city, Dublin, there are, I think there's one treatment bed for every 400 addicts in the city. It's not good enough. You know, we need to, if we're serious about addressing those issues, we need to put in place the resources. Then in terms of the other end, in terms of in Garda Síochána, I mean, there has been a 10% cut in the numbers of Gardaí. 140 Garda stations have closed. Hundreds of vehicles have been taken off the roads out there. Morale is very, very low. So if you can get a situation where you have a, and of course the recent scandals don't help that challenge, but if you get a situation where, you know, you are properly resourcing the Gardaí, where there is a strong relationship through community alerts, neighbourhood watch with communities, and I commend the issues that John talked about, you know, in terms of joint policing committees, drugs task forces, you know, they have a very important role in that, but they need to be empowered.
Would that make much of a difference to what John Mooney was talking about, you know, the scale of the diesel laundering, the cigarette smuggling, the farming fraud and corruption, etc.?
Yeah, in terms of the talking about the cigarette smuggling first, we had a presentation to the Oireachtas from Retail Excellent Ireland, and they talked about, you know, just, you know, common sense, you know, about around scanners for, you know, trailers at ports, using apps to, you know, go into markets where, you know, illegal cigarettes are sold. Everybody knows where they're sold. Go in and deal with that issue. And they were offering to, you know, resource, you know, and contribute themselves towards it. They were critical of the policing of it. So there's a lot of work to do there. The issue of diesel smuggling, and sadly, there are people who would have called themselves Republicans. I don't call them that. They're criminals. People who are involved in criminal activity, reckless activity for their own personal advancement, are not Republicans. So that needs to be said out loud, clearly. There's a big challenge there, particularly in the border areas. There's obviously people who are presenting as legitimate businesses who are not. It's taking huge amounts of money away from the exchequer. So we need to confront also the grey areas. You know, there are people who, you know, feel, ah, sure, I can get a pack of cigarettes for £3. Mm-hmm. Actually, there's not a great deal on the diesel I got there. You know, we have to be honest with ourselves. You know, there is a market for these products, and unless we collectively as a society accept our responsibilities, then there'll always be criminals.
So what, should the government cut the duty on cigarettes? I mean, that's a huge problem, the price of cigarettes.
They've been stalled. I mean, the price increase has been stalled for a number of budgets now. But I do think that, we just need to have a dialogue about where we have failed in our health policies, in our conversations with people. I mean, there's been a whole plethora of efforts to, you know, take people away from addiction to nicotine, a whole range of efforts. But the fact is that there is clearly a market. People, you know, are struggling financially. They've got an addiction. They'll take the cheap deal. But the problem is, the accumulation of all of that is the enrichment of some really nasty pieces of work out there.
Dave, you wanted in there.
I think in a way, John painted a picture, a fascinating picture in terms of what he's calling organised crime, which I can understand. But there are two different worlds we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. In that world, that's where the state is maybe not gaining tax and, you know, revenue as a result of it. But on the other side, there is how communities themselves are being set, and including in rural areas, and I think John's right to point that out, a lot of the drugs problem has spread right across the country, despite all the warnings of people like Citywide, the drugs campaigning organisations, that's been allowed to happen. What would worry me now with that sort of picture is that takes the eye of the Gardaí off where they should be serving, which is at a community level. Because as they go after these bigger, you know, scale operations, they are then moving away from where these problems arose in the first place. And I think that has never been fully resolved. And I think the issue, and I started off and I say it again, the issue of where violence breaks out, where that sort of activity takes place and the trauma attached to that hasn't gone away at all. And that is likely to continue as long as there are, you know, amounts of money available for dealing, for buying and selling. And as Padraig pointed out, And also the downside of that, the impact of that in terms of the addiction, in terms of the youth services getting reduced resources and to deal with it, all of that are the issues to me.
And give me some examples, Dave, of what you see in the communities in which you work. You say the age profile of those involved in the violence is getting younger, families are divided, and the impact of the viciousness of the violence is very real.
Yeah, exactly. I think there was one example last year when they claimed they arrested one of the larger West Dublin gangs. They arrested five people. They were from the ages of 17 to 22. Okay, that's who they said, the guards at the time said they had arrested the leaders. Now, whether that's true or not is another issue, but that's the sort of shift that's happening. The implication of that shift is, and with the availability of guns, is that you're going to, if you don't somehow deal with that, and I don't mean by purely a policing approach, if you don't deal with that issue, it's like it'll fester and it'll become worse. And if they think they can sort of contain it and leave it happening in certain areas, Finglas, Ballyfermot, Clondalkin, and that somehow it'll go away from there, that's not going to happen. So to me, the real issue now is trying to pull it back and a focus, the focus back to dealing with where communities are most impacted by crime. And not forgetting all the other issues, but getting the focus back there, because it'll drift away from that issue, and it has begun to drift already.
I've just been handed a news story that as part of an ongoing investigation into the sale and supply of controlled substances, Gardaí from the Ballyfermot Clondalkin drug unit searched a house there this afternoon, and they discovered 13 kilos of cocaine with an estimated street value of 900,000, 1.5 kilos of heroin, with a street value of 225,000, two men, 31 years of age, arrested at the house. So just a snapshot, I suppose, of what's happening, very really happening in areas at the moment. John Redmond, you wanted in.
Yeah, sorry, can I just reply back to the cuts? I am not a bit happy about the cuts, especially at local level, just as was discussed.
Your Labour councillor.
Yeah, I'm not that happy with the cuts, but that's right across the board in every aspect of community life, and everyone's suffering regarding the cuts. Regarding of seizures and the Criminal Assets Bureau, it was established a number of years ago, seizures of tens of thousands, millions of euros. And I'm asking the government, why cannot that money be spent in areas where they're affected by drugs and antisocial behaviour and criminal activity? You know, we could roll out lots of programmes between drugs, playgrounds, drug rehabilitation for addicts, you know. That's where the money needs to be spent. If it's seized by these individuals who are peddling their wares in communities that are being devastated by that, it should be spent and put back into the areas. Yes, there are cuts. There's no getting away with it. But what was the government left to do? You know, we have to cut somewhere. And I'm not one bit happy about it.
John? No.
Yeah, I'm listening here, and I have to say part of me always distinguishes sort of that local sort of violence, because I know a lot of the kids that have been killed in the past number of years. I know pretty much all of them, and would have encountered them at some stage, and organised crime. Like, the interface is there, obviously, because the product is being supplied into these young lads who are using it. I think what's different about the manifestations, that I say the these small groupings of people that kill one another as part of these feuds and that kind of thing, that these are kids that were kind of lost in their early teens. They're painted as mobsters and this, that and the other, which they are. They're abducting, there are people they went to school with, murdering them and everything else. But they were kids that grew up in a particular culture and got into it. And if you look at sort of organised crime, particularly in the Dublin setting, once a criminal group establishes itself in an area because there's demand for whatever it is in that area, drugs or whatever type product that they're selling, they don't go away, it stays there, and the people just get replaced. So if you look at, say, for example, Finglas, you look at these characters since the mid-90s, there was the PJ Judge, he was shot by the IRA or anti-drugs movement at the time, then he's suddenly replaced by Marlo Hyland, who's shot by members of his own gang, and you go through all these names, and it's just one person replacing another. And without any sort of significant input being turned around to say, OK, let the police deal with that end of thing, but how do we stop this people buying this? How do we keep people away through juvenile diversion projects, etc., from getting involved in that? But again, Audrey, it has to be stated, this stuff is going on all over the country at the moment. Heroin is a ticking time bomb in rural Ireland at the moment. Heroin's a very interesting drug, because it fools the authorities into believing that it doesn't exist. And people in rural Ireland, they've seen this phenomenon in Britain as well. When it got into places like Yorkshire and rural communities out there, it gets into a community, and people, if they've come from a semi, you know, background where they can finance their addiction for a while before their lives become totally dysfunctional, they'll do that for a number of years. So what you'll see, start with, in my opinion, what we'll see in the next year or two is the social consequences of heroin, and then suddenly we've got this massive problem. I mean, the guards, I've never met a guard. And I know a lot of them who are involved in frontline policing in terms of intelligence in dealing with sort of drug trafficking, thinking that the security response to this can beat it. At the moment, these gentlemen are completely right. There is no dedicated strategy by the government, and there hasn't been, in terms of dealing with providing assistance to people who went to get off drugs, effectively in terms of opiate abuse in the Dublin region. They're just medicating them on methadone and keeping them addicted to that. So it's a huge, huge issue.
You Dave. Know?
But in a way, you paint a picture there of, as if it, you know, people are helpless in the circumstances where you name different individuals, prominent individuals who've come up through those areas and sort of got involved in violent acts against each other. But that is not the full story. The wider story is the impact that is having. And there has to be another way of engaging with and trying to deal with that issue, rather than, as you say, let it fester or heroin breaks
out
again.
No, I'm not saying let it fester.
I'm saying rather than let it fester, what about the possibility of beginning to try and engage with some, particularly of the younger people?
And well, they've done that in the States, and they've done that. There's a very interesting policing
And it's been done in other countries. I don't mean by policing now. I'm really looking at it maybe from youth services and others.
But that is going on to a degree. I mean, there are people trying to talk to kids that are getting wrapped up into this. Mm. I mean, I did some work in Scotland on a project up there where they had a particular problem with knife crime.
Yeah.
And they went out. Yeah. And strangely enough, the first group of people that they tried to help were actually young single mothers who were rearing kids in areas that this was developing in. And they said, OK, we're going to get the kids into school. We're going to feed them. Yeah. We're going to keep them in education, set up every conceivable type of sport activity to keep them away from this activity. And and then they went and started arresting the kids that were involved in this, saying, we're going to start locking you up unless you stop carrying knives.
Yeah.
And we won't come near you, and we'll support you in whatever way we can.
Well, that's what I mean, is that it's happening in Scotland, you've mentioned in England, in Birmingham, in the States, that there are other approaches that we need.
And Dave, are you advocating sitting down and talking to the crime bosses, those higher up the chain?
Ultimately, you would like to think that we would find a way through this crisis, which isn't going to go away, and I think it's true. The drugs war won't be won. In fact, many of the top police in Britain, just across the water, have been talking about having different approaches altogether to drugs. But I think who the crime bosses are, I'm not sure. Hmm. John maybe says he knows most of them, so maybe he can talk
to
them.
But do you think I mean, what would you talk to them about? How would you talk to them?
I think you need to begin to look at a way to broker or to mediate, to stop the sort of damage that can break out in communities in Dublin.
I think there's a difference between talking to kids that are getting wrapped up
into
this.
No, I don't mean kids. I mean families and people who get
caught up. But I think you can do that. But in terms of someone living down in Costa del Sol who's sending in 20 kilos a week,
they're never going to.
No, they're the bosses. We've called them the bosses. Yeah. That's a different issue. But certainly there has to be a way, or even when you talk about crimes, you know, within the prisons system, for example, a lot of those who have come from criminal gangs are in there. Is there not some ways that we can begin to engage there? Something that is different. I mean, the drugs issue was challenged by communities themselves coming forward, as you know, 10, 15 years ago. Most issues in Dublin City have been challenged by local communities doing it. Yeah. I just think there's room here. Rather than us be stuck with this, you know, tragic circumstances, which is going to continue perpetuating itself, that we begin to look at new ways of engaging with it. And I'm not pretending I have any simple answer to it, but I do think there could be a way of, I mean, in the past, or if you look at what happened in the North 20, 30 years ago, where it was more political violence, there were ways of mediating between it. Local clergy got involved, other people who were respected by both sides got involved and reduced the conflict.
But when this is a livelihood for people, you know, what's in it for them to stop?
That's where you have to start dealing with. But at least you could stop the tit for tat thing that you've highlighted.
The only thing that I'd say, particularly on the gangs that engage in this feuding, these kids haven't got they've got quick money on occasion.
Yeah.
But they're not living in palatial style mansions or anything like that. These kids
they're doing it for debts that they have. Sure, you're writing about this all the time.
And they're you know, it's like you'd know yourself from Finglas. Like, I mean, but these kids have a kind of nihilistic outlook about themselves. They've no sense of value or anything like that. Okay, there are the criminal elements that are the kind of ruthless thugs that kind of oversee the whole thing. But on the ground and stuff like that, these are kids that primarily get wrapped up, and I have friends that have known them and have kind of told them, you're going to die. And sure enough, they have been killed 6 months later.
OK, so it's how to stop that cycle. It has to be part of the challenge.
Yeah, but that's a youth issue and getting in, dealing with kids and, you know.
And learning from other countries.
John Redmond.
Yeah, just on the youth topic, I know in Finglas, and I've been working with youth and football teams for years and years, but we do have a Garda Diversion programme in the Den down in Finglas, and we have outreach workers that go out every single night engaging with these young fellas who are hanging around in alleyways, outside shopping centres, in areas that you wouldn't put a milk bottle out, you know, it'd be too dangerous. Mm. And they're hanging around there, and they're engaging with the young people. And these would be young fellas 14, 15, 16, up to 20. And not alone that, come weekends where normally you'd have the drinking culture or weekends and hanging around and causing problems. Between the FAI and the community guardie and myself, and right across the various parts of the city, you have midnight footballs taking place. And that works for 5 or 6 weeks, and then you have the finals. And we have up to 30 to 40 kids every Friday night between 10 o'clock and 12:15. And those guys are going straight home because they play anything up to 5 or 6 games. And they're in no form for hanging around, believe me.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is positive stuff, getting back to what we just discussed. Yeah. Rather than let this thing fester and say this is a problem, these guys are going to be... They're getting younger. They are getting younger. These individuals are getting younger in their late 20s, early 30s, and then they're finished. They're either bumped off or something else happens to them.
And that's a terrible scenario.
You can't keep living terrible. With that. It's terrible for communities. And I know the families, and I'm talking to mothers who live in the Finglas area who had their kids assassinated because of drugs. And it's heartbreaking for communities. And we really need communities, as was said by the people here, John, and everyone I think is in an agreement, that we need to have the resources to help these families in working class areas.
And more creative ways of doing it as well. It's not a money issue.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think there's a full spectrum here. You need to increase resources to projects that John and Dave have talked about, absolutely. Then there's the issue of the criminal justice system. That's when, you know, when people are going through the court system, you know, I mean, if you look at, if you were to analyse the approach of district judges throughout the state, there's no consistency in the decisions they're making. If you look at the use of community service, you know, as a deterrent rather than sticking them into jail, the public sometimes might think, oh, let them do the time, but here's the problem: they go to jail.
And
there's no rehabilitation program. There's a 25% remission automatic if you keep your head down. You know, now I have to say there have been some good encouraging improvements in the prison system, you know, around the use of cells and support structures. But there again, like, for example, our Oireachtas Justice Committee, we put forward a penal reform set of proposals, and it looked at, first of all, the sentencing system, to look at sentences below 6 months, to commute them to community service, look at that as an alternative. Look at community courts, which is apparently going to pilot in Dublin in the near future, which would be brilliant, which is, you know, again, rather than, you know, stick them into jail immediately, you know, with the first offence, get them back in, you know, in through the community. Like, a community court is immediately into the community service, and then, you know, just trying to get them back on the road again. In terms of the prison system, you know, link a 33% remission to to rehabilitation, to training, to actually make, you know, to have an exit strategy that when you come out, then it's into the next part of it then is the Father Peter McVerry's, you know, the arguments he makes. You're sending people out homeless. Mm-hmm. So of course they're going to go back into crime mm-hmm. again. So there has to be a full plan that if, you know, to try and avoid, first of all, putting people into prison if you can, for non-violent offences, mm-hmm. of course. If people have to go to prison, that there's an exit plan, that they come the full cycle like they do in Finland, which is a gold standard. So there needs to be a vision. And who do you listen to? In fairness, you listen to the Johns, the Daves, the Father Peter McVerrys, some of the brilliant people in our prison system. And then, of course, for the violent criminals, then you resource the Gardaí and you build the trust with communities. They give the intelligence to the Gardaí and you put people behind bars if need be. Mm. But there's just a missing joined up approach to all of this.
And I think that's sort of the state, you know, who could better respond. Mm. On the other side of it, and this is the point I'm making in my own experience over the years, where communities are encouraged and supported, they will find solutions. No, so you have to have both sides of that coin. Yeah. And in my earlier days working as a community activist in Ballyfermot, way back when, the whole issue then was to engage with young people, to draw them into whatever was going on, but also, you know, deal with the real world. Mm. If they get caught up in crime or in the court system, mm. they could be forever stuck in that. So you spent a lot of time.
John Mooney, we've had a tweet from Ruama, who deal with trafficked women, and they've said that last year a Garda superintendent told the Justice Committee that sex trade is run by organised criminal gangs, mm. which is what you've been saying, and no surprise to you. What's being done to break up those gangs and to bring the kingpins down, as it were?
Audrey, let me tell you a secret. If they get a handful of these people, they're lucky. Because, number one, these people read legislation. They're not, if you've dealt with these people, it's an enlightening thing to do. Because I've dealt with John Gilligan's and interviewed him, sat down with him and for hours and heard things, should I say, and people say involved in organised prostitution, stuff like that. These people sit down and they know the legislation better than any senior counsel. They don't implicate themselves. Organised, just to explain, like, I mean, there are companies that I know, Sunday Times have been involved in looking at, that I understand they're owned by organ and controlled by organised crime, sort of groupings and people centrally involved. This is huge. I mean, the violence we see inflicted on communities in Dublin and every community, or not just the people in West Dublin or anything like that, it's going on wholesale everywhere. There's this other sort of business that goes on without that, that is criminal in nature, such as the organised prostitution, such as the diesel laundering, cigarette smuggling, whatever it is, it's smuggling animals.
But is that battle being lost by the authorities?
It's not that it's being lost. It's like the state is set up in so far that the Zimmer Garda units deal with it. They target them on a matter of priority. And they spent months targeting them. They'll try bring them to court and try seize assets from them, and it moves on to the next one. And that's the way it goes, because they're simply overwhelmed by the sheer scale of the problem. And it's and what no one likes to believe about this or accept is that, be it with organised prostitution, people are involved in this. If it's diesel, they're not selling to a couple of hundred people who know what they're buying. This stuff has been sold in forecourts all over the country in branded garages and everything else. If it's cigarettes, they're being sold in news agents and everything else. If it's bootleg Lucozade, it's being sold by the truckload through cash and carries and stuff like that. So this is a huge problem that involves, it interfaces with legitimate trade. If that's the best way of describing it. And if they get a lot of these, like, for example, CAB is a very effective group, but many of these groups now, that when they see CAB coming, will settle with them immediately and it's on, sorted, no problem. And will produce, a couple of hundred thousand or a couple of million if they have to pay and get on with it and go back quietly back to business, no problem whatsoever. If people only knew some of the people involved, whom they are, you'd probably fall off your seat because the connections that people have. Like, I mean, I trip over these people the whole time. I can't get on a plane without seeing someone on it that I know from doing surveillance work on them or something like that. I was out for a walk today and I bumped into one of the biggest drug dealers in Dublin, who's, comes across as a perfectly normal fella. You know, I went to school with people involved in this. They're everywhere. No matter where I go, and people that sort of would move in those circles maybe have that sort of knowledge. These people are everywhere. They own hotels, they own breakers yards, they own farms, they own businesses. They've maybe got control of big businesses. Mm. And trying to
sounds
to
like you're describing that. Ireland as it's operating. Yeah. I mean, you're, you've almost included everything there.
That's the way it goes. Mm. And it's a huge, huge issue. And stopping that and dismantling it is very, very difficult, you know. And these are, again, these companies that are household names that I would, certainly if you speak to someone in financial intelligence units or customs or revenue, they everyone knows who's involved in a certain line of work that these are nothing more than money fronts or fronts for laundering money. Like, laundering money is like a virus in the bloodstream of this our banking system. It will never be removed.
Does any of that shock you, Pádraig?
I think it shocks a lot of people listening tonight, in terms of they have a vision, you know, of criminals based on, you know, dramas on TV, you know, and they've got sort of, you know, particular types of accents, and, you know, and certain communities are labelled with it. The fact is that, you know, the criminals that that actually mastermind and oversee these things are often wearing nice white collars, you know. Yeah. And the biggest criminals in this state, of course, you know, bankrupt the state, of course, through our banking sector, you know, if we want to take it to that level. But so I think we need to get real about, you know, our perspective on crime and the full picture of it.
We're out of time tonight, but a fascinating insight to organised crime in this country. Thanks to John Mooney, to John Redmond, to Dave Connolly and to Pádraig McLoughlin. Back at 10 tomorrow night. Till then, good night.
The Late Debate, presented by Audrey Carville, was produced by Donal O'Herlihy. The broadcast coordinator was Maeve Mooney, the researcher Richie Byrne, and sound supervision tonight was by Andrew Kane.